Path of Souls, The Native American Death Journey, Cygnus, Orion, The Milky Way, Giant Skeletons and Mounds in the Smithsonian. All that we'll talk with Dr. Greg Little about when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. We're with Dr. Greg Little, psychologist turned explorer, and a great one indeed. Greg, tell us a little bit about Path of Souls.
Well, Path of Souls explains what the America's ancient mound builders believed about death, what happens at death, the soul. And back when I got interested in the mounds and the mound building cultures, which was actually in the 1980s, up until just recent years, I figured that no one would ever know what these people believed, that no one would ever know what a lot of the strange artifacts that have been pulled out of mounds meant. These artifacts are very, very weird. A lot of them, well, some are on your website now, which you have several good photographs of.
Mm-hmm.
They depict the eye and hand symbol. It's basically like an eye in a palm of a hand. That's been found on somewhere around 50 artifacts that have been pulled out of Native American mounds. There's a host of other artifacts that show skulls with what looks like fire coming out of them, single bones like an ulna, and many others. Some show like a crossbar, almost like a big plus sign, which in the past has been interpreted by archaeologists as the sun. But actually, all of those things are not what they originally appeared to be. The truth about what these groups believed had actually been recovered in the 1700s and the 1800s. And as I put on a video that really is not truly available yet, they became lost because they went into libraries in these old books. They weren't digitized, and archaeologists started digging into mounds trying to pull out artifacts for display. So the written information was lost. But beginning in the 1990s, a group of archaeologists, roughly 25 of them, met at Texas State University every year for around 15 years. And they pulled out a lot of these old books. They did statistical analyses. They actually looked at the old legends and came up with this idea. So I wish I had come up with it. What I have simply done is summarize it. But it goes back to the time when the mounds were first built, why they built these incredible geometric earthworks, how the elite, the priests and the chiefs, maintained control over these cultures, and why it explains a lot of other strange things, like why some people were interred in really well-built stone chambers inside of mounds, and why other people were essentially cremated. There are also mounds that had literally thousands of human remains in them, just kind of jumbled haphazardly. But this Path of Souls explains the death journey, which begins with two souls. According to Native American beliefs, we have two souls. One of them is called the life soul. And the way to think of that is that it animates us. It's drawn from the earth, and the earth has a spirit and a life of its own. And when the body forms, there is this mindless energy that animates us, and that is the life soul. When you die, there is another soul that separates from the physical body, and it is called the free soul because it is free of the body. The life soul, though, clings to the human remains when you die. And if you don't do something with those human remains, this life soul, the natives believe, was dangerous. It could haunt the area. It could cause diseases with other people. It was like a ghost. So they believed that you had to pretty much cremate any human remains that were left and return them back to dust so that energy could go back to the Earth Mother. The free soul then took a trip to the west, And then on this trip to the west, it only had like 3 days to take this trip. It reached a body of water. And then in the morning, actually, if people go outside now, don't quit listening to the radio, but if you're outside now, take a look to the west. Actually, it'll be pretty much almost vertical now. You will see three stars sort of in a line. We call it the Belt of Orion. But the natives saw that as a hand star. It was a severed wrist. The three belt stars of Orion formed a severed wrist. And this wrist falls in the western horizon. Right now, it'll fall about 4 o'clock in the morning or 4:40 in the morning, central time, and right before the sun rises. And so the hand goes down, and the first thing you see that goes down is Orion's nebula, which the Maya called that Xilbaba. But The soul had to take a leap toward Orion when it was right on the western horizon, and it aimed for Orion's nebula, which is the eye in the hand, and it's an ogee, O-G-E-E. The ogee is a portal, and once it got into that, then, of course, the sun would come up. You can't see the stars anymore, and Orion essentially then goes around the earth, and the next night it all goes on again. But that ogee allowed this soul to go through the underworld safely and then emerge the next day or the next night on what is called the Path of Souls, which is the Milky Way.
They had it all worked out, didn't they?
Yes, they did. Oh, this is incredibly complex. I'm really just trying to give a simple explanation.
Yeah.
They believed that the stars of the Milky Way were souls making a journey. That's why it is called the Path of Souls. Some tribes called it the River of Souls. Some call it the Wolf Trail, because when you're on this trail, you encounter dogs or wolves. But eventually, you reach a spot on the Milky Way where you meet a judge, and they called it an adversary. And this is very Egyptian-like. This adversary performs it's a judgment of the soul. And the judgment has to do with the goodness of the soul, how it served its tribe, its family, and how it dealt with its enemies. This judge was a raptor bird, usually a eagle, a hawk, a falcon. And if the person passed the judgment, they then made a choice. They were at the dark rift of the Milky Way at this point, and they could go one direction or the other. One way was a dead end, and if you actually look at the dark rift, you'll see one branch is a dead end. And the other led on to an opening in the upper world, which they believed was a huge dome or a sphere. And you popped out of this, and then you returned to the land of the ancestors, which is really where all the souls are. It's where all the souls start and where most of the souls return, but not all.
Now, Greg, what was Casey's tie-in to this?
Well, Casey did talk. Well, first of all, the Native Americans in this belief, you could make a choice. Families could choose that their dead could reincarnate. Reincarnation is a part of this. It's also like the soul sojourns to different worlds. You would jump to the stars. Your soul would go to the stars. And it was some sort of an evolutionary development of the soul. It's very, very similar to Casey, which I found quite odd when I started reading this. They would take babies, for example, that would die, and if they would be very upset and they'd want another one, they'd want the same soul to return. They actually buried the baby in its entirety in a hill very close to wherever they were living. And if you kept that body together, there was a chance that in the future that that particular free soul and the life soul could rejoin. That's why they put the elite in tombs, because sometimes they wanted this leader to reincarnate and come back. But if you did not want to come back, then your bones had to be literally ground into dust or burned, so you could not come back and rejoin with that same life soul. Therefore, you couldn't reincarnate. Some souls actually made slipped and fell during this journey to the sky, and they either went into the underworld or they reincarnated. And there was another creature, a spider. I mean, it's very complicated. But it's just really interesting. That kind of leads into the giants, too, because these elite were generally very, very tall people. They were hereditary. Having the status of being elite wasn't because you were good at what you did. It was hereditary. You were born into it. And for one reason or another, these were exceptionally tall people. And there's very good evidence of that. Some people have called them giants. But archaeologists hate that word, giants.
Yeah. And how tall do you think they were, Greg?
Well, we know how tall they were. They were between 7 and 8 feet tall. The evidence is real clear at this.
Not really big, then.
Well, no, that's pretty big. When you're talking to, I stood next to Wilt.
We've got seven-footers now. That's my point.
Yeah, we do. But let me tell you how many there are. It is one of every 146,000 people. That's the exact statistic. One of every 146,000 people is actually 7 feet tall. Now, that's not very many. And in their world, and that's based on modern statistics, in their world, where their height was 5 foot, their average height was 5'4" in the Adena population,
right,
where most of these were.
Like the Mayans, the Maya, they were small people, too.
Yes, they were like 5'2". On the average. And so if you actually apply the real statistics to all this, what you come up with is like one of every 1.5 million people at that time reached 7 feet in height. But somebody who's say 7 feet 8 inches tall or 8 feet tall, if you stand next to that person and they are proportional, that is, they're not skinny, they look like a giant.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's no doubt. But to me, show me a 9-foot giant or a 10-footer.
Yes, well,
that's a giant.
Yeah, there you go. Well, I can't do that. What we focused on, and Andrew Collins and I did an analysis of this, we took all the old Smithsonian reports, which is actually 842 pages, and found 17 that the Smithsonian pulled out in their mound excavations in 1882 to 1890. They found 17. And then the University of Kentucky pulled 7-footers, 7.5-footers out in 1950. The Carnegie Museum pulled them out in 1958. And another group of archaeologists did the same thing in 1956. And all of these that archaeologists did. Now, I'm not talking about all the newspaper reports where they reported people much taller. We decided to look at the actual reports done by archaeologists during real excavations. So what we came up with, the truly valid reports that cannot be denied by mainstream archaeology, there's around 37-footers to 8-footers that were pulled out of American mounds over a relatively short period of time. And if you multiply those out, you'd have to pull out somewhere around 10 to 12 million skeletons at the time. Actually, more than that. It'd be more like 35 million if you use the Adena heights to come up with that many tall people. And that's a lot of skeletons. We know the Smithsonian didn't pull out 40,000 during their entire period of digging in the mounds. They dug into 2,000 mounds, but they only came up with 40,000 artifacts. We don't know how many skeletons they actually found, but we know they found 17 that were 7 feet to 8 feet in height. So that's what Andrew Collins and I did. We really looked at the archaeological publications. We did run down quite a few of the others where there are these reports of much taller people. Several of those do have validity to a point. The problem is that at some point the evidence just kind of ends. There's nothing else that we can do with it. So you have one article that leads to another that leads to another, and you can go back into time, but where you're left is some individuals in a town somewhere, maybe a local doctor is named, and they reported finding these skeletons, but it's... No archaeologist has measured them. That's the problem. Archaeologists don't accept that stuff. So we wanted to get the ones that they themselves actually pulled out to see what was there. But there's far too many of these 7 to 8 footers statistically. Something was going on in that world. And we know through the legends that the Native Americans had what that was. The legends were very clear, and all that was done in the 1700s and 1800s. The legend said that in very early times, these huge people came into the Americas when there were already people here. They were very fierce warriors. They really couldn't resist them. But not only were they fierce warriors, they had abilities and knowledge that far exceeded what the native populations had. These tall people are Native Americans too. I want to make that clear.
So you don't think they were extraterrestrial or anything like that?
No, I don't think they were extraterrestrial, no. You could go back, and an argument can always be made that there's extraterrestrial intervention that went on at some point, some sort of genetic intervention. And I've written, it's in the Path of Souls, I've committed to it. I do believe that sometime in the ancient past, there probably was, statistically speaking, it's probable that there were visitations in the past. And there's a lot, you know, there's a lot of things laying around on the earth that are very, very strange. To me, the best evidence is, though, the legends from Native Americans that tell us that their remote ancestors came from the stars. That's very clear, but that's their really first ancestors. And some of the legends actually say that in the beginning there were these advanced beings that came down and created man and woman. That's actually Cherokee legends. And those were recorded by the Smithsonian in the 1800s. So that's old, old stuff. But
it appears so that the Smithsonian seems to have hidden some of this stuff.
Well, they can't really hide it. They just don't like to talk about it. And I've concluded that the Smithsonian's problem is one of three things. One is just utter stupidity, which I know there's been some stupidity. They should have addressed this Giants thing, but they didn't. Another is abject incompetence, which we know, too, in recent years, the Smithsonian has come under intense scrutiny because of financial issues, and it's pretty clear that they have some real problems there in recent years. Or the third thing is that there has been a real conspiracy, and I don't know what to say about that. I do know this. You've had David Childress on, and some years ago,
sure.
David Childress talked about the Arizona newspaper article, the front page newspaper article that came out in 1909 about an Egyptian artifacts recovered from a cave system in the Grand Canyon. There was a Professor Jordan who supposedly was affiliated with the Smithsonian who was involved with that, along with a guy by the name of Kincaid. Childress made that known in the early 1990s, and the Smithsonian put out press release after press release that there had never been a Professor Jordan ever working or affiliated with them. Archaeologists have repeated this, and there are textbooks out, mainstream archaeology textbooks, that say there has never been a Professor Jordan ever worked for or affiliated with the Smithsonian. But if you go on the Smithsonian website, and you actually go back, you can find in 2008, they issued a page about a Professor Jordan who worked with them for 30 years, who actually did make a trip into the Grand Canyon.
All right, stay with us, Greg. We're going to come back and talk more right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Dr. Greg Little as we talk about these mounds, the skeletons, the giants, and Edgar Cayce. When we come back, let's talk a little bit more about the mound builders talking about having two souls. I still find that fascinating. Back in a moment. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Greg Little with us. Greg, the mound builders and these two souls that you talked about, why did we have and why do we have two souls based on their perception?
Well, it's real similar to the Egyptian idea of the Ba and the Ka. One soul is physical. It comes from physical matter. It animates the body, and that's called the life soul. It allows the body to move, but it's also the source of hauntings, ghosts, probably poltergeist phenomena or anything else like that. That particular soul comes from a sort of a coalescing of physical matter to provide a vehicle for the free soul, the thing that we really define as our real soul. The life soul has no memory. It has no free will, per se. It's just kind of a free-floating energy that coalesces together. But it's dangerous unless it's dealt with. That's the point to it. This other soul, the free soul, is what most of us define as a soul. It has a memory. It has sort of a personality. It has a real history. And it sort of stays together. It doesn't dissipate after death. It stays together into a unified whole, and it moves on. Or it can re-enter something else that's physical on Earth and essentially reincarnate. But that gets really complicated at that point. Why did they believe it? I do not know. I know what the beliefs are, but I'm kind of dumbfounded by some of it. Why did the Egyptians believe that we had two different souls also? I mean, I don't know. I think these beliefs go way, way back in time, probably to roughly 20,000 years ago. 18,000 BC is the date that Andrew and I have pretty much settled on, and that has to do with the way the constellations were in the sky and what the North Pole Star was, because they believed that the souls went through a portal that was once at the North Pole. And again, going back into these ancient legends, it points back to antiquity, true antiquity, 18,000 years ago or more. The giants didn't appear to enter the scene until the time mounds were first beginning to be built. And they were real clear about how they came in. They were seen as invaders, but they brought knowledge, and they sound like the Nephilim. They brought knowledge of cultivation. Maize entered the Americas, or corn entered the Americas from Mexico around the same time that mounds started being built. And they learned other types of cultivation. And the civilization in the Americas took a rather profound leap forward about the time that mounds were built. And that goes back to between 4,000 BC and 3,000 BC. And it appears that's about the time that this almost invasion of giants occurred. And there weren't a lot of these taller people. The legends say that some of them were twice as tall as the natives. And they do say that point blank.
Okay.
Other legends say that, the more recent legends say that they called them giants, but they said they were just exceptionally tall people. Noticeably taller, and that they were proportional in size, so they had a frightening appearance. And it also says they were cannibals, and that's interesting too.
I had heard that, and it's kind of frightening, isn't it?
Yes, that is frightening, but that's a good way to control the population. Supposedly, well, in more way than one. I didn't mean that how it sounded. Supposedly, these people had the knowledge and the power over life and death and reincarnation. And the populace gave them their power and turned them into the elite because they controlled the death journey through the manipulation of these symbols that we talked about briefly, some of which are on the Coast to Coast website. And they also they controlled the population building the mounds and building the earthworks, and these were ritualistic devices. The earthworks, the geometric earthworks, were ritualistic devices, almost machines, that were employed to assist souls making a transition between this world and the next, and allowing souls to come back in. So they were devices, and it explains a lot of things that have been absolutely unknowns, such as why did they build some of these massive geometric formations like in Newark, Ohio? It's an incredible place, or the geometric earthworks that were at Portsmouth, Ohio, which are just as incredible at Newark as Newark, but most of them have been destroyed there. But they built hundreds of these things, octagons, huge concentric circles made out of earthen rings that were 12 to 15 feet high, miles and miles of earthworks, walkways that went 56 miles that were lined on each side by parallel lines of earth. All this has to do with rituals and manipulation of the soul. And supposedly all of it was done at the behest of these elite people who were really tall people, because they had this power. And the legends also tell us how they disappeared or how they got rid of them and why. And that's an interesting story in and of itself. And it's a lot like Casey's story of the end of Atlantis.
All right, what happened to them?
Well, two things happened. All the Native American legends say that these giants, as the elite, as they got more and more powerful, they became corrupt, that they demanded more and more from the population. And finally, when their demands reached the point of what is called in these legends sexual improprieties, the population rose against them and exterminated them. That is, that last sentence was a quote from one of the Native legends. The few that were left fled, and I believe they fled south, and they went into what is called the Mississippian mound culture, and there weren't a lot of them left by the time Hernando de Soto came.
Would that have been like Cahokia mounds?
Yes, the time of Cahokia, yes. Most of these giant skeletons have been pulled out of the Ohio River Valley. The Kanawha River in West Virginia is one where there were a lot of them. That's the biggest concentration. But they've been found elsewhere, too. But the real concentration of them are Edina-era mounds, really old mounds going back to about 1,000 B.C. and before, in that Ohio River Valley. But there were mounds built earlier in the South, and, of course, the Mississippian era, which came later, built the big pyramid-shaped mounds. And that's Cahokia and Moundville. Spiro, Oklahoma is another example, in Etowah, Georgia. There's hundreds of those sites. There were a lot of mounds. There's probably 100,000 still in existence.
100,000? Why so many?
100,000 mounds probably still in existence. Most of those are relatively small burial mounds, and those are the ones that archaeologists really like to excavate because they found the most in those. And a lot of those have very elaborate stone chambers in them. And I am not a proponent for excavating. Somebody actually posted that we shouldn't be digging into mounds. We don't dig into mounds and never have, never will. And at this point, I don't really know any archaeologists who are doing any active excavations into mounds anymore because they can't. Since 1990, the passage of the law called NAGPRA, N-A-G-P-R-A, has pretty much prohibited that without the Native American tribal permission, and that's almost impossible to get. So from that aspect, American archaeology and real excavations, it's at a standstill. There's still archaeology going on, but it's mainly archaeology that is coming in before construction is being done. When roads are built, they have to come in and do a survey to make sure they're not going to destroy anything. That's an example. And that's most of the archaeology going on today. It's not excavating mounds, which I wish we could do a few, because I'm sure there are some of these very tall people still in there. And with genetic testing, we could find out where these people came from and if, in fact, they do have some sort of a genetic link to perhaps Denisovans, as several people, including Andrew Collins, have suggested. I don't really know who they are, but unless genetic testing is done, we will never know for certain, and that's the only way to do it.
Getting back to these double souls, Greg, I've always believed that that's a possibility, because
couple things happen, especially on this show. One, people call in and they've talked about how they have seen their dearly departed visit them. And then on the other hand, it happens like months after they have died, where I have assumed they have moved on or they've already been reincarnated. And I'm trying to say to myself while these calls are coming in, well, how can the soul be visiting a loved one months after they probably have already moved on? And it didn't click. It does now when you say that there could be two of them.
Well, that does make good sense, and the truth is I've never thought of it that way either, but that makes really good sense. It does explain things like hauntings where you have the same thing happening over and over. And as you said that, what I was thinking of, I have been in hospitals after close relatives have had massive strokes or have had other problems, and their body is alive and their body is functioning, but the person you know is no longer there. And a lot of times, my wife has said sometimes, their soul has checked out. Their soul, what we consider the soul, has moved on, but the body doesn't know it. The body stays alive, and that makes sense from that perspective, too. And maybe that's where they got the idea from, because surely somebody would have been physically alive, but not been there, if you know what I mean. Personality-wise, they're gone. So well, that makes sense.
They are gone. Back to Edgar Cayce then for a moment. How significant were these mounds to him?
Well, Cayce really had... I interviewed Edgar Evans Cayce about mounds back in... it was actually around 1999 before Edgar Evans died. And Edgar Evans was his son, and the Cayces lived in several areas where there were lots of mounds, and Edgar Evans said that, well, they talked about mounds being in the area a few times, he said, but they never visited a single one. There were 68 Cayce readings that mentioned mounds. Out of the 14,000-plus readings, there were only 68 that talked about Indian mounds. And they were not given a great deal of importance. There was a lot of information in those 68 readings. One example is he said that mound building began in the south and moved northward to Ohio, which at the time he said that, archaeology textbook said mound building began in the Ohio River Valley and then spread elsewhere, but we now know it did in fact begin in the south around the time frame, Cayce said, 3000 BC, and then went north, so he was correct. But to Cayce himself and his family, it really wasn't important to them. Cayce was struggling to make a living as a photographer, so they just did not visit mounds and didn't have an interest in any of that. And that's really, it's peculiar when you think about it.
Well, it really is. So of everything that you've been working on with Edgar Cayce, everything he's done, what do you find to be the most significant aspect of his life?
Wow. The health readings, clearly. They helped so many people. And the health readings were very accurate. Since those were done, the ARE has made a concerted effort to collate those. ARE has got 25 to 30,000 members. A lot of them are physicians, health researchers, nurses, psychologists. Every profession you can imagine is in it. And they have made health protocols for almost every disease you can think of, which is a listing of all the things Cayce said to do for this disorder. So pretty clearly the health readings are probably the most important thing overall, at least to me. Some people would say it's the spirituality. I definitely have an interest in the things Cayce said about the ancient world, but I have to admit if I stack that up against people's health and well-being, people's health and well-being is more important than anything I would do about looking at the ancient world. I am, however, fascinated with the Native American beliefs. I am very fascinated with these ideas of star people and how far this goes back and what else could be found about it. The Native American beliefs are probably the closest thing we have that just flat says our ancestors came from the stars. They say it very, very plainly. And it's just clear that they're legends and their myths are not what people think of as myths. There's got to be some basis to it. There's some truth to these stories.
Greg, two separate astronomical groups are saying now that there could be two extra planets in the solar system. We've had guests on the air here for years who've talked about the possibility of a planet X, an extra planet in the solar system. Did Edgar Cayce ever address that?
I have no idea. He probably did, since he addressed virtually everything. But I don't know. He may have, but I don't know. In the next break, I will find out.
Okay. Now, with those health readings that he gave, and I've got a book that I got, which shows most of his natural remedies. You know, he talks about eating 3 natural almonds a day to prevent cancer and things like that. You know what? I bet a lot of medical prescriptions are based on some of the things he said.
Oh, absolutely. Cayce really talked about, you know, a balanced diet, but it goes beyond that. He talked about eating fresh fruit and vegetables, not a lot of red meat. Fish is something he talked about. And if you actually break these things down, he was talking about taking things like niacin and niacin-rich foods to lower cholesterol for heart disease. Of course, they didn't talk about cholesterol then, but he talked about nuts as being useful for the body's balance. And we now know that nuts actually increase the good cholesterol, and niacin actually can decrease bad cholesterol.
That's right.
But everything he talked about was about cleansing the body. He said most of our problems come from our bodies being out of balance. We were usually too acidic, and he talked about alkalizing the body. I think the highest selling book the ARE has ever put out with their publishing house has to do with alkalizing your body. In fact, I think it's called Alkalize or Die. And that remains the best selling book. And a lot of people follow that Cayce prescription. But of course, they do a lot more. The ARE has conferences there every year. They have a university. They have a master's degree. They have all kinds of online courses and study groups. It's just amazing. And tours. They're going to Cuba this year, which is pretty astonishing, because I was pushing to go to Cuba some years ago. And it had to do with Andrew Collins speculating that a part of Cuba had been Atlantis. So the ARE is going there, but they cannot go to this specific site yet. So I'm waiting to go to this particular part of Cuba at some later date.
Hopefully. That would be exciting, especially if that possibility happened.
Well, absolutely. And Cuba remains a dark area with archaeology, meaning almost nothing has been done in Cuba archaeologically.
All right, Greg, stick with us. We're going to come back in a moment here on Coast to Coast AM, and we're going to take phone calls with you about all these subjects next.